Good morning. Well, this morning we're talking about our sermon series, Out of the Boat. And we're coming full circle from where we began 8 weeks ago, where we find Peter and the other disciples fishing along the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus comes along and says, "Follow me and I'll make you fishers of men." We're talking about dreams today. Big fish, big dreams. Fishing is an interesting sport, one that I really don't care a whole lot for. Not much of a fisherman. In fact, you can ask me to do a lot of things, and that's probably one that I won't get out of bed for. I remember it probably happened when I was about 9 or 10 years old. When I was younger, we used to go vacationing in a place called Clear Lake in California. It was up in the Napa Valley area of California, beautiful wine country. And I remember my dad would take us up to this lake every summer, and we'd stay at a resort with a lot of our friends. And beautiful setting, Clear Lake. You could go out on the dock and look down, and the water was so clear, you could see 10, 12 feet down, and you could see the bottom. Just absolutely pristine. The lake was about 30 miles across by 15 miles wide, and surrounded by the Sierra Mountains. On the far side of the lake, you could see one of the mountain peaks, and going up the side of the hills, you could see the beautiful vineyards crawling as they would up there. And I remember one time we were up there, and me and my friends, Johnny and Ross, we decided to go fishing one day, and our dad sent us out in a little fiberglass boat with one of those little whiny engines. It was so much fun. I mean, here we were, us three little guys, and all of our gear, and a 5-gallon bucket to put our fish in. We made our way out down along the shore, and finally found an old, abandoned, broken-down dock, and we tied off to one of the pylons. We cast our lines into the water, and we no sooner had hardly let it hit the water when all three of us had a bluegill or a crappie on the line. It was so exciting. Our adrenaline was pumping. We couldn't believe it. Three fish. And so we reeled them in, and we put our little crappie and bluegill into the bucket with a little bit of water. And we were just anxious. We cast again, and pretty soon three more fish. And this kept happening over and over and over again. We were catching fish like, I mean, we must have just hit a swarm of a school. And it was interesting because that day, for a few hours, couple hours, we caught 154 crappie and bluegill. We ended up having to dump our bucket out. We just simply had the boat just loaded with all of these fish. It was incredible. And I mean, I've never caught so many fish in my whole life. As a little boy, I mean, it was the biggest thing you ever saw. You talk about big fish and big dreams. And so we made our way back towards the resort to the dock, and our dads were out there working on their big, huge jet boats. And as we came in, they had that look on their face of, "Well, boys, how did you do?" And sure enough, they asked, and we were just grinning ear to ear as we came in. And as we got up there, they saw the amount of fish we have. I don't know what the legal limit was, but I'm certain it may not have been 50 fish per kid. But as minors, I'm not sure it was even important. We had caught all these fish. We were so excited to show our dads and brag about 154 fish. And then my dad said the words, "Well, boys, good job. You're going to have to go up and clean them now." Oh, my goodness. We had to clean, cut, and gut 154 fish, which we ended up having a fish fry that night for the entire resort. I hate fishing. That was the moment I decided that this was not something I enjoyed. Now, I do enjoy eating fish. In fact, the other night I took my daughters out on a date, and I took them out to Red Lobster, and I loved it because they brought us all the fish, all the shrimp we needed, but we didn't have to clean a single one. So, I'm a dreamer. I love to eat fish. I hate to eat fish, but this takes us to the story where Peter and his friends are going out fishing. In fact, they're standing around, and I love the words that we find in John chapter 21. You find this guy Peter on the Sea of Tiberias, also known as the Sea of Galilee, and they're sitting around with the sons of Zebedee, which are James and John, and probably his brother, Andrew, and they're sitting around, and you know what they're doing? They've started a business up. That's right, they went out and bought some nets, and they got themselves some boats, and they're out fishing. In fact, I like the way it says it here. Peter's sitting around, and he looks at the other guys. He says, and he's probably just contemplating. He says, "Hey, guys, I'm going fishing." The other two guys look at him, and They look at each other. And could you imagine the conversation? What are you going to do today? I don't know. What do you want to do today? I don't know. What you want to do? I don't know. What you want to do? And the other one say, hey, we'll join you. Now, what's amazing about it is they weren't called to be fishermen. They were called to be fisher of men, Luke chapter 5. And now we've come full circle. You see, their dream is gone. Following Jesus and all the incredible things they saw for the past 3 years, their dream of being fisher of men has died along with Christ. The day they saw him crucified on that cross is the day their dream died, and that happens so often. Are you a dreamer today? Have your dreams been shattered? I'm a dreamer. I love to dream. In fact, my parents would say I'm a huge daydreamer. I can daydream all the time, and as a little boy, I certainly have had my share of imaginations and dreams and thoughts and different things I want to do with my life. And anybody that knows me knows I'm a dreamer. Whether it's stockholders or church or this or adventures, no matter what it is, I'm a dreamer. But so often our dreams die in the darkest of nights. They say dreams come from a place called REM. In fact, it's called rapid eye movement in psychology. When I was studying psych in college, we learned a lot about this. They say in the deepest part of your sleep is REM, rapid eye movement. What happens is your mind is unwinding and it's finally really resting, and you have the majority of your quick dreams there, and it's a way to replenish your body and your mind. And that's what REM is. In fact, they say if you could look at the eye and lift the eyelid, you'd see fluttering. The eye is just fluttering back and forth as you're doing this. And that's thus the name REM, rapid eye movement. It's the deepest part of our sleep where our dreams are. Well, this morning I want you to know it's in the darkest part of our life that we really need our dreams. It's where we really need our REM. And so that's what I want to talk about today is our dreams and getting those in the darkest part and having those reestablished. You see, it was during this time that Peter went back to the things he knew. And that's what REM is, rapid eye movement. I want to talk to you about the R and E and the M of our dreams. The R is the rapid. When things get hectic and chaotic in our lives, rapid if you will, that's when we seem to go back to the things that we're familiar with. We kind of go back to our old ways. Isn't it true? I mean, think about this, guys. In your life, when things get hectic or chaotic or stressful, don't we revert back to our old ways? Ladies, isn't that true? Think about that. I mean, you know, they make fun of it in movies. It says, you know, when things kind of get chaotic and crazy and rapid, you know, you always see the woman say, "I'm going home to my mother." We tend to go back to our security blankets. We go back to places we find that make us feel the most comfortable. In fact, we try to find that, and we see that in Peter. Peter goes back to what he knows. He goes back to what's comfortable in his life. We go back to those things. And you know, the interesting thing is, as we do that, the danger in that is that's not what God has for us. That's not the dream. That's not the thing that's supposed to be a part of our lives. That's not a bad thing. For instance, as a pastor, there's been many times in my life, even as a Christian, I've thought about going back to old ways. I've thought about going back to studying pre-law. If the church thing doesn't work, or if I'm just tired, and I tell you, bad days come to preachers too, and I think, that's it, I'm done. I am not going to be a preacher anymore. And I've called my mom up on the phone. That's right, I call my mom too. Mom! And we do. We go grab a hold of our security blankets. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with security blankets so long as we don't substitute that for the true security of our lives, the faith in our lives. And the faith in our lives needs to be the rock. The rock, the foundation, is Christ Jesus. And to substitute that is to have a substitutionary thing that we trust and put our hope completely in. The Bible says anything that's not faith, apart from faith, it's impossible to please God. Anything that's not faith is sin, the Scripture says. And so we want to make sure that we don't substitute the thing that God's trying to do in our lives with something else. I know in my life I've thought about going back to things. I took a college course here to finish up. I thought one day I would try to finish up my college degree. And I took a course at SC4, better known as Blue Water U. And I went over and took a upper level 400 class for seniors, a CSI course. And I thought, you know, I'll just finish up my degree. I remember there were times in my life where I was planning a church in Alabama, and I met a gentleman by the name of Homer Dobbs. And he was this multi-millionaire, super nice gentleman. And he rented out in Hoover, Alabama, a suburb of Birmingham, very, very plush community. He rented us out a storefront that we remodeled for our church plant. And I remember he'd come in, and we'd meet oftentimes, and this guy had more businesses from Alabama to Florida. He just had money. He was a member of the club, this incredible building on the top of the mountain, right in downtown Birmingham. You can see from all four sides of the city. And he was a member of that thing, and he just had more money. But he'd come up to me and say, "Brother Mitch, I don't get you. You're a fine preacher. You're very articulate, and you dress nice." Now, I like Homer. I liked that he was very observant. And Homer would, he would say to me, he said, "Brother Mitch, I can't figure how you spend your time, and here you and your family are putting all this into this church. That's fine, but you're a young man here that's a fine young man, and you could be making six figures." He didn't say figures, he would say figures. He says, "You could be making six figures, and if you ever want to change careers, you let me know." And I thought to myself, well, Lord, six figures, $100,000, I should be switching careers any day now. And it'd be so easy to fall back on those kind of things, but that's not what God called me to do. God called me to a dream in my life. He called me to a vision, to a statement. But it's so easy at times to want to go back to our security, to go back to our old ways. And that's what Peter does here. Isn't it amazing that the body's hardly even cold? In fact, Christ doesn't get cold. He rises from the dead. But even within a week, you find Peter going out and buying a boat and starting a business. Not a bad idea, but not what God had for him. God had a different plan. But his dream died when he felt Christ had died. And I think that happens to us so often. So in the rapidness of our lives, how does that translate? Well, in the church, it translates this way. You find oftentimes in the church, when things start getting stressful in the church and things start happening like they have here at Grace, as things are exploding and starting to move, and maybe even as people start feeling comfortable, that they begin to bring all kinds of ideas or other thoughts into the church. In fact, most of us have packed our bags in other churches. Most of us have packed our bags in other teachings. And we bring all of our luggage into Grace Ministry. Now, I have to say this the right way. I talked to my wife last night. I said, "Honey, pray for me. I don't want to say this the wrong way." I have people, and now as a senior pastor, bringing me books and ideas all the time. In fact, this week I've received, I think in the last couple weeks, about six books people have given to me to read. "Pastor, oh, you got to read this. Pastor, you got to read this." And people have all these different ideas. "And Pastor, we've got to have this in our church. And Pastor, we've got to have that." Now, I don't want to be unapproachable. And people have a lot of great ideas. And so I told Susan, I said, "Really pray about how I convey this. But let me just be straightforward here. And this is what the Lord laid on my heart." It's so easy for people to bring ideas in, and we have about 200 ideas here, to say, "This is what we ought to do, Pastor, as a church." And we tend to, you know, go back to the things that we're most comfortable with. And when we do that in religion, it becomes traditionalism, what's called the red camel hair couch. I was in a church one time that was split. I preached at a church in Alabama, in the Nazarene church. They had a red camel hair couch in their foyer, and they wanted to get rid of this thing because it stunk, but they couldn't because it was donated by brother and sister so-and-so, and why, we can't get rid of that. And it became a golden calf, so to speak, of the Old Testament. It was an idol, a traditional thing that just could not be moved. And I've seen more things, whether it's an organ or the drums or it's the hymns or the choruses, I've seen more things in church that say, "I'm bringing and unpacking my bags here, and I'm unpacking what I know and what I'm familiar with." When we start doing that, rather than doing what God says, we get into trouble. It's what I call the snow globe. I have a snow globe I keep. In fact, here it is right here. I keep this snow globe as a reminder of how easy it is to get lost and tracked in what my position and role is as a pastor, as a visionary. This snow globe is really nice, and you shake it up. That's what we do, see that? And all the snow falls really nice on the little village. Well, everybody comes along and they say, how nice, oh, how cute, look at the snow. And they shake the snow globe up. And then it begins to settle. And somebody else comes along and they shake the snow globe up. And the thing is, it's so pretty on the outside, but I've learned as a pastor, God shared with me that I live inside of that snow globe. And they begin to shake it up. That's grace mission. And they begin to shake it up. And I'm in there going, whoa, it's a blizzard. See, for them, it's really pretty. For me, it's a blizzard. And 200 people have to shake the snow globe. And see, as soon as things start to settle, they want to shake it up again. They want it to be snowing. Now, for me, I don't want it to snow. I just know the village. I know what it is. I know the picture. And so sometimes that's the way the ministry is. Everybody has all these opinions. And I remember saying to Pastor Steve one time, pastor in a church of 800 to 1,000 people, and I said, how do you do it? All of these opinions on the way the church ought to happen. How do you do it? He says, well, somebody will come up to me and just say this or that, and I'll just say, uh-huh. And I'll just listen to him and kind of smile and shake my head. And then I'll kind of walk away. He says, then another one will come along and say, do it this way. And I'll kind of smile and shake my head. I said, you've got all of those people to keep happy. How do you do it? He says, I just smile and shake my head. But he knows what he's all about, and that's how he does it. Because there's a lot of great ideas. Don't get me wrong. I want to hear what you have to say. I want to read the books you're reading. I want to hear what's happening in your life. But I've learned that that's not always a great thing, because if we focus on that, we're trying to please people instead of pleasing God. And that's what's happening here with Peter. He's lost his vision. When things got rapid, when things got crazy, he lost sight, and he's following. He goes back to what he used to do. And we tend to do that. We have to be careful that we don't return to the former ways of our lives. And you say, well, how do you do that? How do you keep from falling back on those ways? How do you keep from going back to old habits or old traditions and things that may not be bad? As the scripture says, you know, let's throw off the sins that so easily entangle. And let's throw off those things that beset us. Not the sins, but there's things that entangle us. So there's sins, yeah, we got to get rid of those. But there's also just things that just slow us down from running the good race, it says in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. And so we need to say, well, this is probably a fine thing, but not for me. That's not the dream God has for me. And so how do we do that? The word is discipline or discipleship. No wonder why in Matthew 28, the last thing that Jesus wanted to say before his death and resurrection to us was, he says to his boys, he says, boys, go into all the world, verse 18, 19, and 20. Go into all the world and make what? Disciples of all nations. He wants us to be disciplined, to discipline our lives, to do it over and over again, to make sure we do it right. And that's what God calls us to do. How do you overcome going back to old ways? Well, that's easy. You create such a pattern, such a habit, that you could actually do it in your sleep. Ah, we know it in our sleep. I know our vision for Grace Ministry in my sleep. And I'm going to communicate that. And you'll say, he said that and done that so often, I could say it in my sleep. You know, we are that way. Some things we do, we're so disciplined in it, we can do things in our sleep. I said I'm a daydreamer. I tend to daydream. Have you ever done this where you're driving down the road and you start just to kind of daydream? And the next thing you know, some time has passed and you kind of snap out of it. And you think, how did I get here? I know what some of you are thinking, because I know it's happened to me. You're thinking, well, of course it's happened to you. You've ended up in Toronto or New York on a youth trip or lost somewhere. I understand, have your fun. But the truth of the matter is, my wife was watching Good Morning America the other day, and they actually talked about this. They said, it's true. People actually can sleep while they're awake. And I thought, you know, of course I knew it, because I do it all the time. I'll be driving down the road, and I don't even have to think about my blinker. I don't have to think about my signals. I don't have to think about the speed limit. I just have done it so often, so many times, over and over and over, that I'm disciplined, that I know I'm going to do it the right way. And I do it the right way, even when I'm dreaming. And I want you to know that if we discipline ourselves in the rapid times of our lives, in the hectic time of our lives, rather than have the old response in our lives, we're going to have the new response in our lives. We're going to have the thing that we discipline ourselves to do over and over. But we have to do that. And Peter goes back to fishing. He goes back to the old ways. And it's so easy to do that in religion. And I don't want to be about that. In fact, I know that our vision over and over and over God shared with me on that Friday night when I said, yes, Lord, I will plant a church. I will start a church, and I want it to be different than everything else that's happening in the community. Because we're doing things sometimes, and if we don't change something, the churches will never change in America. They say they're closing about 3,000 churches every year in America. That's an amazing statistic. And I know a lot of them are springing up, but they're closing them too. And I want to be different. And so God shared with me. He says, Mitch, step up, step in, or step in, step up, and step out. Step into my grace. I want you to share and be a church that's all about salvation. Let everybody know that I love them. I love them. I desperately want to have a relationship with them. Let them know how in love I am with them. Step in, that God will accept you no matter who you are, no matter what you've done. God's love and forgiveness is great enough, and He's strong enough for you. Step up, that every person wants to make a difference in someone's life. If we said, would you like to make an impact on someone's life? Would you like to be a miracle? Absolutely. I would love to be a part of that. And step out, that church doesn't happen inside the walls. My relationship, my Christianity is not defined because I go to church, but rather I go to church because of my Christianity. You see, I'm not defined by a Sunday morning service for $5 and a good show. Too often we have these things and everybody just focuses the primary on what happens inside of the building on a Sunday morning as their faith and their religion. And rather than that, Jesus Christ never defined himself that way. He is defined throughout the Gospels as being outside the building. In fact, we almost never even hear about anything that ever happens inside of the church. When Jesus spends 3 years of ministry recorded on a daily basis, it's always outside of the building. And I want to have a ministry that says, this isn't a show that you paid $5, walked out of the movie theater and said, that's a fine show. I don't want it to be that way. If that's the case, let's shut the doors. God says, I want this in your life. And so I know that that is our vision and our philosophy. And if I keep focused on that, even all these great ideas. And folks, I got to tell you, there's some wonderful things. I get phone calls every other day, it seems, from national ministries. Or, hey, we want you to try out our program. Hey, we would like you to have our Sharing Jesus Without Fear. We'd like you to have the Contagious Christians Seminar Workshop for your church. Hey, Pastor, we got this for you and that for you. And you know what I do? I have a litmus test, and I simply run it right through that. And if it doesn't fit, then it doesn't fit into our church. And I know there's a lot of great ideas, and you guys have some great ideas, but you know what, folks? We're not going to live in a snow globe mentality where everybody gets to come and take a shake and then expect that the snow needs to fall their way. We are going to say, God, you are the vision, you are the dream maker, and you have given us a dream to step in, step up, and step out. And Grace Ministries is about that vision. And if it doesn't fit, thank you for your idea. But you know what? Here's where we're going, and we'd love to have you a part of it. And if it doesn't fit into you, I'm sorry, but that is what God has called me to do. I will not go out and buy another boat and another net and do the same thing that I used to do, because that's not what God's called us to do, and that's not what God's called you to do if you're a part of Grace. The second thing is that we need to have an eye. You got the rapidness that needs the discipline. Well, then you got to have the eye. Isn't it interesting? Look at it, verse 4. It says, early in the morning, Jesus, he stood on the shore, but the disciples, what? They did not recognize him. Now, how do you spend 3 years with Jesus, raising the dead, casting a demon out of a guy in a cave called Legion, for they were many, into a swarm, a herd of pigs that jumped off a cliff? He walked on water, he calmed storms, he saved their life, raised Lazarus from the dead, and you don't know who this guy is? Isn't it funny how we don't know sometimes this Jesus we proclaim? Because maybe we just never had our eye on him. Maybe we had our eye on all the things that were happening around him. We need to get our eye on Jesus. And there's four things that happen right here that we can get our eyes on Jesus. Look at these unusual things in Scripture that happen. It says in verse 6, first it says, or in verse 5 it says, haven't you caught any fish? No, they said. In verse 6, throw your net on the right side of the boat. Now I find that to be interesting that he says the right side. He could have said the left side. But he says the right side of the boat. I think it's allegoric that God's just simply saying, I want you to do things the right way. Peter, fishing isn't a bad thing, but it isn't what I have for you. And you're not even very good at it. I mean, let's be honest, folks. It took a carpenter to tell the fisherman how to fish. Isn't that great? The best fisherman out there was the carpenter. And it says they caught such a large number of fish, 153, that they couldn't eat. It says, but the nets didn't tear. I love this. Now watch this. The carpenter knows how to fish. This isn't in the notes, but don't miss this. God wants us to know a few things here. The first thing he wants us to know is this. He knows your business. These guys could say, what do you know? You're a carpenter. Go build a chair. But no, they don't. They know this is the miracle man, and he can do anything. He knows my business. Listen, there are a lot of people in this world, and maybe you're one of them, that says, you know what? I like my religion. But you know, when it comes down to it, God doesn't need to know my business. He can know my religion. He's a religion man. But when it comes down to it, I mean, what does he know about the economy in Michigan? What does he know about the things that are happening in my home? What does he really know about the pain I'm having with my children? What does he know about my marriage? What does God really know? You know, he can be my religion on Sundays. But folks, he says right here, you need to know something. I know your business. And he tells them, throw the nets on the right side. Do it the right way. And man, look at the miracle. Immediately they recognize this is Jesus. He did another miracle. They know who he is because he gets in their business. Listen, if you let God get into your business, he's going to do miracles in your life. And that's a great thing. And then it says the second thing is, Peter recognized it. He wrapped himself with his garment because he had taken it off, and he jumped in the water. You see that there? He jumps into the water. Now, I find this to be hilarious. It's Peter again, of course, in verse 7 and 8. He jumped out of the boat. Folks, we got to jump out of the boat when we recognize it's Jesus. We got to get out of this comfortable place we're in, very nice, floating on top of water, and we jump in. Now, Peter didn't do it the way I'm going to do it. He's already in his shorts. If you're going to swim to shore to see Jesus, stay in the swim trunks. Why are you putting the towels on? That's just going to sink you. But, of course, Peter being Mr. Rambunctious, spontaneous man that he is, he jumps into the water. But it's interesting, it says, then the other disciples followed. You know what? God needs some of us to jump out of our boats so that other people can see the miracle and say, now that's a God worth following. Some of us have never gotten out, and others are just waiting to see this God we talk about to say, if you can do it, I can do it. It's like when I went cave exploring down in Tennessee. I took our youth group, and I rented to go into one of the largest caves in North America, underground caves. It's just huge. It goes, I mean, about a mile down, and there's all these cave crawls. There's a lake at the bottom of this thing. And so I rented out at midnight so we'd have this experience in the dark in this cave. Okay, you can explain that to your neighbor. It's dark in a cave at 2 in the afternoon. It's dark all the time. Anyway, but I got it at midnight to have this really awesome experience. And we went in these cave crawls. And they divided us into groups of about 5 or 6, and with our flashlights. And they took us in these incredible small things. One called the birth canal. Self-explanatory. The other one we went into was, I couldn't get through the birth canal, by the way. I already done that. Don't need to do that again. We went into a thing called the Superman. And why they called it the Superman is, this thing went down, I don't know, it just went forever in this little round hole into the in underground, in the mountain, and you had to lay down like Superman with your arms out and crawl an inch your way, I mean, feet after feet, I mean, 40, 60, 100 feet, and you had to make this sharp left-hand turn, go into this other area, and then you could crawl back out through another tunnel. And I'm looking at this thing thinking, you got to be kidding. Am I going to fit in this? And all the guys on the team, yeah, let's go. This is going to be great. And I said, okay, as your youth leader, I've decided to take it upon myself to let you guys go in there, and I'm going to bring up the rear. Thinking to myself, if somebody got stuck, I am not going to be in front of them where I can't get out. And there's no fire department that's going to get into this cave way down here to get us out. And so I'm looking and looking at the size of these guys thinking, if they can do it, I can do it. Hey, as a youth leader, you can do that, okay? That's your prerogative to tell the kids to go first. And so they went in there, and they did it, and I did it. sometimes we just simply need to go first so that other people can see the miracle of God and go, man, you just did that. If you can do this, if God can do this in your life, then maybe God can do it in my life too. And we got to get our eyes on Jesus and follow the vision that God has so that others can jump out of the boat with us and follow to Jesus. Another thing is 153 Untorn. I had a t-shirt given to me years ago, a youth group called 153 Untorn out of Buffalo, New York. I went up to visit their program. 153 Untorn. It's interesting that the Bible uses an exact number. Very rarely does the Bible use exact numbers. It usually rounds them off or uses them symbolically, like the 12 disciples. 7, a number of purity. 3, a number of power. And so in this, 153, why? And you know, we just got to rack our brains theologically. Why 153? Why did they write that? Here it is. Because they caught 153 fish, okay? Pretty simple. But there's something more here. Some writers wrote that they believe that science knew, or at least the people of the day knew, there were 153 species in the Sea of Galilee at that time, known species of fish. So what God is saying here is, I want you to know the dream is bigger than you. Your dream is bigger than you. And he says to Peter, Peter, I'm going to go so far beyond this that this dream is for every species, every tribe, every language, every tongue. The Chinese, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Russians, the communists, the Democrats, the whites, the black. It doesn't matter. This dream is for everyone. I am for everyone. I want you to know I love everyone, and I want you to take them this message. And it says, and even the nets did not tear, which was unusual. And it says, I have the strength to give the dream to every nation. Trust me. Trust me. So we got to get our eyes on Jesus. And when we do that, we can trust in God. And then finally, rapid. Trusting God to get past those times through discipline. I, keeping our eyes on God so that we don't get sidetracked. And then movement. We've got to have movement in the church. We've got to have people up and moving. There's just too much sitting. There's too much watching and grandstanding. There's an interesting thing that happens here in verse 15. It says, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? Three times he says this, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, well, yeah, I love you. Peter, do you love me? Well, yes, I love you, Lord. Peter, do you love me? And the third time, it says that Peter was hurt. Because he was asked a third time, do you love me? You know what's happening here, don't you? What's going on here? That's right. Peter had denied Jesus three times, and then the rooster crowed. Remember that? Peter in the courtyard there during the trial, and people asked him, and three times. So Jesus is restoring him by three times. You would think Peter would be excited and say, oh, I know what's going on here. Jesus, oh, he's giving me another chance. The dream is coming back. So then why is Peter so sad and hurt that Jesus does this? And the third time, that's when it says, Peter was very hurt. Because more is going on here than you can see. See, the beauty of foreign languages, it brings something out that the English language can't find. Do you love me? That's what we think he's asking. But the Greek has five words for the word love. And two of them are used in this story. And when you understand this, get this. Watch what happens. Let me read it to you the way it says. Peter, do you agape me? Now the word agape is the highest form of love in any language. It's unconditional love. It says, even if you don't love me, even if you don't like me, even if you hate me, I will love you. Even if you don't respond, it's Christ up on a cross saying, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. It's Christ saying, even if they don't love me, even if they don't care that I'm saving them, even if they don't want my salvation, even if they don't want me to take their place and die for them to keep them out of hell, I will still do it. Even if they don't care, I will love them. No wonder why it says in Romans 5:8, but God demonstrates his love in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And so that's what's happening, agape. Now watch, though, what happens. Peter, do you agape me? Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. Oh, a different word here. Phileo is the word where we get Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. That's what it means. Phileo means a brotherly kind of love. Now he responds and says, I love you like a brother. Now that's interesting, because now those of you that have brothers understand that that may not be, that definitely not agape love, okay? Brothers tend not to have that completeness, especially when they're younger. But it says, Peter, do you agape me? He says, yes, Lord, you know I phileo you. And he asks him a second time, Peter, do you agape me? Oh, Lord, you know I phileo you. The third time he asks him, now watch this. Peter, do you phileo me? Oh, you see what's happening? Jesus comes down to Peter's level, knowing that Peter can't answer that. And he says, do you phileo me? And Peter, it says, and Peter was hurt, because the third time Jesus asked him, for a third time he asks him this, do you phileo me? Because Peter so desperately wanted to say, when he asked him, do you agape me? Oh God, Jesus, yes, God, yes, I absolutely agape you. But he says to him, you know all things, Lord. You know. And I phileo you. That's all. You're right, Peter. Then he goes on and restores him. You see what's happening here? Now watch this. Peter's desire, watch this, his desire is to say, oh Lord, I agape you. But his actions, he knows, speak louder than his desire and say, I phileo you. You see, Peter, didn't he show with his attitude his desire? Remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, I would die for you, Jesus. I'll never deny you. In fact, he takes a sword out and cuts Malchus's ear off, one of the soldiers that's arresting him, because he's so passionate to say, oh, I would do anything. And before the night's over, before the whole night's over, his dream is dead, and he denies Jesus with his actions and three times denies him. And that's us sometimes. We have that desire to say, God, I love you. I love you. God, you're the desire of my heart. And before the day is over, sometimes our dreams are smashed to the ground. And that's what's going on here. Our actions and our attitudes. This happened to me this past Wednesday. I was with our youth leaders at my house doing a discipleship meeting. God just opened up my eyes to something that was incredible. And we end up going back to the whole math thing of graphing a chart. And you know how graphs are in a math. You know, you have your top row and you have your side row. And on the top, I said, write down God. Now, go from top to bottom next to that, on the left of that, just write down, are you giving God your best? Are you giving God, how about the second thing, write down good. Is God getting just good from you? Is he getting your okay kind of? You know, each day, are you giving God your okay? Or on the fourth line, right, he's getting kind of barely sort of in my life. I'm giving God just barely anything each day. And I want you to just then put an X, because you got God there, that's your line, your graph line. Under God, check off one of those four. And then go across the top next to God and go to the next line and put family and put entertainment, put sports, and put these things down and give them about five categories and say, I want you to mark. Now, are you giving entertainment in your life? Are you giving fun in your life your best? Are you giving it good? Are you giving it kind of? Are you giving it barely, sort of? And your family, are you giving it best? Are you giving your family good? Are you giving them kind? And write down each of those and go across. And now they charted their graph, and it pretty much started looking like mountain ranges as they connected those X's up and down and across the board. And I asked the students, I said, could everybody be honest with me? Just could anybody share with me, if you've given God your best, who's giving God their best with their actions? They're giving him everything. Would you raise your hand? And one student kind of raised his hand and said, I believe I am. And that's it. And this was the leadership team. And I said, do me a favor. Write down across the board. Now, I want you to write 1 through 5, 1 being the most prioritized thing in my life and 5 being the least thing I'd prioritize. And I want you to write next to each of those, 1 through 5, what you would say would be your desire. God, family, entertainment. If entertainment, boy, that's the number one thing in my life I desire, that I really want. Not that I'm doing, but I really want that. And write that down. Now go ahead and graph that. And I want you to think about this yourself while you're listening to me. What would you put as your number one desire? Now let me ask this. If you would, raise your hand for those of you that said that God would be your number one desire. You would want to give Him your best, and He would be the priority. Oh, wow. Almost everybody. Okay, and the rest, I would imagine, let's do this. How many of you put family? Is that okay, the remainder. That's pretty much 100% of everybody. And that's what happened with the teens. And I said, isn't that interesting? Nobody could raise their hand and say that God... Now, let me ask you. How many of you would say you're giving God your absolute best? He's getting best in your life. Nobody. I know there's room to grow, and so maybe that's part of it, but let me say this. To say I'm giving God my absolute best, and He's also the desire, you see that? The one thing that we desire to be our priority, our attitude, does not match the actions that we're giving it to Him. But the things that we don't want to have, maybe that's a 5, maybe entertainment or sports or other things or our job, that's getting our absolute best and it's getting our priority, it's getting everything in our life. Isn't that interesting? I believe that God is calling us to, because the same thing happened to Peter. He says, I desire Jesus to say agape, but I can only get to phileo with you. Maybe even not even storge, another Greek word. But you know what? I just want to get close to God and bring those two things together. When we bring our action and our attitude, our desires together, and they become number one with God, watch what happens. I believe when we do that, the graph goes straight across the line, and all of those other things become high priority. They all become action that we give best to our job, to our family, to our entertainment, to our recreation. When God is number one, it goes the line in a graph doesn't look like a mountain range. It goes straight across, flat line. It's a perfect line, straight across the board, and everything's in its place. You say, Pastor, that's crazy. Well, let me show you. Turn in your Bible to Matthew chapter 6, and I'll tell you how crazy I am. As you're turning over there, you're turning to the story where Jesus is teaching, and in His teaching, He's talking to His disciples, and He's really trying to build this concept in. He says, guys, do not worry. Because these guys are worried about their food, they're worried about their clothes. Some of these guys are probably at this time in their life, it's early in the ministry, thinking, man, I just walked away from a lucrative job. Well, you, I used to be a fisherman. I mean, I had my own company, Peter's Fisherman Incorporation. I mean, I had employees, we had boats, we had guys, I mean, responsibilities. I just walked away. In fact, I didn't even sell my boat, I just walked away one day from it. Yeah, what about you? I had a tax collection business. Matthew says, I mean, look at me. And Luke says, I was a doctor. Hey, guys, I don't want to hear it. A doctor. I was the head of Galilee Forensics. I mean, whatever it was. These guys had the jobs. And you know what? They're thinking, what was I thinking making this number one of my life? Something's happening, and Jesus is just trying to teach them. I don't know what kind of conversation's going on, but Jesus comes along and says, do not worry about tomorrow. Look what it says. Do not worry about what you will wear, what you will eat, what you will drink. We spend so much time worried about shopping and entertainment and our jobs. Now, remember, God knows these things. And He says that. God knows these things. But then He says in Matthew 6:33, He says, but instead, seek first His kingdom and His righteousness. And what does He say? And all of these things will be added to you as well. And all of these things are what we talked about. That God will make everything in your life. He'll make it the priority. He'll make the best in our lives. When we make Him the best, He'll make everything else the best in our lives. And He will take care of us. Isn't that a great concept? I believe that's where the miracles happen in our lives. When we line up our attitude and our action, we get the altitude of God. we rise up. No wonder why so many Christians today never see the miracles of God and the kind of life that people say, I want that in my life. Because even though they have the desire, they never have the action that follows the desire. And the action is where the faith is exercised. And so how do we do it in closing? That's a great question. I had a young lady ask me that this week. She said, Pastor, what is my response ability in all of this? For me to, I want to have God as number one in my life. And I want to match it up with myself. But what's my responsibility in that? That's a great question. I think everybody should ask that. And I said, well, what's your responsibility in dieting or lifting weights and exercise? You know, people say, oh, I'm working out, I'm dieting, I'm trying to get this body. I mean, I'm trying. I look on TV and I see these commercials. You know, for 5 minutes a day, you can try this ab lounger. And I mean, isn't that an oxymoron? Ab lounger, okay? You don't even have to sweat. 5 minutes a day and you'll look like this. And then they show these people these just incredible bodies. And I'm thinking, no way. Maybe 5 minutes on the ab lounger, but then 20 hours on some kind of intense weight machine. Or take this pill when you go to bed and wake up tomorrow looking like this. I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me. It's just not possible. Or you want to diet? You want to look like this? And we just sell ourselves short, thinking there's no responsibility on my part. It's a pill or it's a little rocker chair. And that's the responsibility. It's somehow its fault. And we do that religiously too. We say, well, you know, it's God's responsibility. It's the pastor. Boy, if he was just a better preacher, if this were a better church, I would be a better Christian. My family would be better if I had a better marriage counselor. Our kids would be smarter if we had better teachers. What's the responsibility? And I told her, I said, here's what it is. I said, your responsibility is 100%. You. It's you, 100%. And there was just this pause on the phone. And you need to understand, here, I'm telling you, I don't know where we got our bags packed, but it's bad baggage, and let's not unpack it here. Let's repack and understand this. If you want a stronger faith, if you want the dream in your life, it is yours 100%. It's not the weights. You can't look at the weights and say, well, I'm just not in shape because I've got a terrible weight machine. I'm not losing weight because the food. I'm not dieting right because of the food. I'm blaming the food. I mean, good grief, last year I heard that a family was suing McDonald's in New York because they were fat. Well, listen, it's not McDonald's fault that you're fat. It's because you've stuffed your face with 50 cheeseburgers and French fries and Cokes every other day. You can't blame McDonald's, the food. But we want to do that. It's not my responsibility. The entire response that we need to have is this. You want to be a stronger Christian. You want the dreams of God. Then it is your responsibility. You need to change your diet and wake up in the morning and people look at you and say, what in the world is going on? You look great. Man, I want you to pray for me because you look great. I mean, you change your diet and say, God, I'm putting a diet of the Word of God in my life instead of a diet of television or a diet of this book or a diet of the negativity. And you start putting God into your life and that kind of diet, the next thing you know, people are going to look at your shape and they're going to go, man, I don't know what it is about you, but would you pray for me? Because when you pray, there is strength. You're a lean, mean, fighting machine. Look what kind of shape you're in. You're pumping those irons. You're putting those weights to work. You're exercising your faith with God. And the minute you do that, you're stronger. People look at that and say, wow, I want to be a part of that. And so what is your response in this? Well, it's 100%. You want dreams? You need to have REM. You need to, in the darkest part of your night, you need a dream. You need rapid. That's discipleship, so you can do it in your sleep. You need eye, you need to focus your eyes on Jesus so that you can see the miracles of God. And you need movement. And the movement is to move your action equal with your desire, your attitude. And then, and only then, will you see the miracles of God in your life. God bless you.